you didn't know it already, you might be disturbed to find out a very small percentage of the materials you put in the recycling container, things that you've, you know, carefully washed and put in there, very small percentage of those are actually being recycled now. And we'll talk about efforts in Sacramento to try and change that and to create a larger recycling and reuse market. That's to come next hour here on Air Talk. Right now, it's the case of a 21-year-old Bay Area native, Peter Zhu, who was a West Point cadet who died in a skiing accident. And he had given consent for his organs to be donated. After he died, not only were his organs removed, but sperm was retrieved from his body. And his parents went to court requesting the right to be able to use their late son's sperm to produce a child. Now, there is no precedent for this. Spouses or domestic partners have been in the position where they could do that. Certainly, if someone had written out their intent to donate their sperm for use in creating a child, that would be very clear legally. But in this case, New York Supreme Court Justice John Colangelo ruled that since there isn't a law against the parents using their late son's sperm to produce a child, that they were legally entitled to do so. This raises a host of legal and ethical issues, and with us to talk about them, Dean-elect at the Chase College of Law at Northern Kentucky University, Judith Darr. She's also the chair of the Ethics Committee of the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. Thank you very much, Dean Darr, for joining us on Air Talk today.
A pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me, Larry.
So let's talk about first the absence of law here. It seems like just from my quick read of this, that's sort of what the judge was saying. There's not a law against this.
That's correct. And the judge relied on two pieces of law in New York that are related but not directly addressing this particular situation. And he looked at the organ donation law and the ability of the parents to consent to the retrieval. And he also looked at laws governing estates, the disposition of property after death. And from those, he reached what he called inferential emanations from these laws to permit the parents to consent and possibly use his reproductive material moving forward.
Under organ donation laws, are sperm and eggs treated as organs for the purpose of the law?
The law was drafted in the 1980s, and it doesn't specifically address a sperm and egg per se, but there have been interpretations of the law that extend to the ability to retrieve and donate these materials, and that's exactly what happened in this case.
But then it would seem it's still silent on the issue of whether you could use retrieved eggs or sperm for producing a child.
That's exactly right, because when one donates a heart or kidneys, it's used to sustain another person's life in the life that they have. But obviously, when we use gametes posthumously, they're used to create another life, and that has very different implications, both in law and in ethics.
And with the judge's ruling here, how much weight did they give? Apparently, multiple people testified to the fact that Peter Zhu, the young man, had said he looked forward to being a father, wanted to have multiple children. But of course, it's a very different thing to have one sperm used for children you will not be personally raising. There's no wife here or significant other who would be bearing the child. So is that something you can infer from the young man saying that he wants to be a dad?
Yeah, and we have to recognize that we all have an interest in our reproductive activity, whether it's during our life or even after our death. And the judge did give great weight to the fact that he was an only child, that he had talked about the import of family in his life, but there's no way that we could know, either now or in the future, if he would want to be a parent in this way. If he'd want a child to be born, which he wasn't able to participate in their rearing, in which possibly his parents would be this child's parents. It's just impossible for us to predict. And we take what is a very tragic situation with extremely well-meaning and earnest parents, and we do the best we can. And I think that's what happened in this case.
There are ethical guidelines from the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, for which you chair the Ethics Committee. Does it directly address this issue?
It does. And the judge cited our policy in the opinion. We actually take a different position than the one that the court took. We say that requests by spouses and life partners are appropriate, but we do not necessarily think that parents or other third parties are the appropriate decision makers. And so we essentially would have discouraged the court from acting in this way. We provide guidance. It's not law per se, and it's just an opinion that tries to look at all sides of the issue. And there are reasons why we took the position that we did, limiting retrieval and use to spouses and life partners. And if I may, just one of the main reasons is we can understand that a spouse or a partner would have a joint reproductive plan with the decedent, and that's appropriate. But on the other hand, it's really not appropriate. In fact, it's discouraged by law and policy for a parent to have a reproductive plan with their child. And just based on that appearance alone, in our discussions, we took the position that we didn't think it was appropriate for programs to move forward with requests by parents or other third parties.
We're talking with Judith Darr. She's the dean-elect at Northern Kentucky University's Chase College of Law and, as I mentioned, chair of the American Society for Reproductive Medicine's Ethics Committee. And this is her area of research right here, bioethics involved in reproductive medicine. Just one other issue, is there any cooling-off period here where the parents are you have to wait before a child would be conceived using the sperm from their late son?
There's nothing formal in law that talks about a bereavement period, but mental health professionals highly encourage those who are in this position to take this, as you say, cooling off or bereavement period. And the recommendation is anywhere from 1 to 2 years. So nothing per se, but given the difficulty of the circumstances and then the time for reflection, I certainly agree with those mental health professionals.
Also joining us is Professor of Medical Ethics at New York University's School of Medicine, a frequent Air Talk guest with us, bioethicist Arthur Kaplan. Professor, thank you for being with us again. Do you differ at all in your perception of this decision from Dean Darr?
I don't. I think the dean is right, although I'm probably even more strong in my disagreement with the judge. I think trying to stretch the law governing organ donation to include reproductive material, sperm or eggs, is really stretching. Those laws had nothing to do and didn't even countenance the possibility of reproduction as part of what you were talking about when you filled out a donor card to be a kidney or a liver donor. And I also worry, you know, this means in vitro fertilization with a donor egg, someone that the parents would have to find to also be a surrogate. And so you have a third party introduced here whose rights and ability to become involved in parenting a child isn't at all clear. It could even be that the parents are older. I don't know how old they are in this case, but let's assume they were in their 60s and maybe they became ill or died. You have a situation where the child's best interest isn't looked out for without a dad, without these parents trying to parent the child themselves, and the stranger sort of lurking on the side. So I think it's very bad public policy to let parents do what's happening here.
We're talking about the case of a 21-year-old West Point cadet who died in a skiing accident. Peter Zhu of Concord in the East Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area. After his death, his parents went to court to attempt to get the right to use sperm retrieved from their son's body so that a child could be conceived or children could be conceived using their late son's sperm. There is no spouse, no significant other here. New York Supreme Court Justice John Colangelo sided with the parents in the absence of specific law on this, said that they have the right to do so. Now, Art Kaplan, our guest, actually wrote the first bereavement period, waiting period for a hospital. That cooling off period that I had just raised a couple minutes ago. We'll hear more about that as we continue in 1 minute on Air Talk. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. I have to say, our Air Talk listeners posting on the page, not fans of the judge's decision in New York State involving the sperm that was retrieved from a 21-year-old Bay Area man. He died in a skiing accident. His parents wanting the right to use his sperm that was taken after his death so that they could have a grandchild that would be created from their son's sperm. Judge siding with that Bay Area couple. We're talking with a pair of bioethicists, Arthur Kaplan from NYU, where he's professor of medical ethics, and Judith Darr, dean-elect of Northern Kentucky University's Chase College of Law. She chairs the Ethics Committee for the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. Art Kaplan, I just wanted to get a little bit more about this bereavement waiting period or cooling off period before gametes could be used by a spouse, significant other, or this one case by a parent. What are the criteria that you came up with for University of Minnesota's Med Center?
So this was 32 years ago.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. They could do the retrieval then, huh?
Yeah, and we had a gentleman die in the backyard from a cerebral aneurysm, brain blowout. His wife had heard me talking on public radio, of all things, about the possibility of sperm procurement. She said, I would like to do this. When they brought him to the hospital, he was pronounced dead, and she said, I'd like to do it. So we assembled quickly a team to figure out what to do. And I made a couple of points then, which was, one, I said, we might take the sperm, but we have to insist on a waiting period. My suggestion was 6 months. Judith mentioned that mental health people say maybe a year or two. But the idea was grief may pass and you may decide this isn't what you want. And in this case, it was the wife, not a parent, by the way. Also said maybe you cannot transfer the sperm to a third party. We even talked about that you could have one child, but not more. Wow. That still remains today. And in any event, we did procure the sperm, and interestingly enough, after 6 months, the wife said she did not want to go through with it, and the sperm was destroyed. So I've seen that a few times since then. People, once they wait, kind of come to terms with the loss and decide maybe the procreation isn't the way to go.
How widespread are these bereavement waiting periods?
Well, each infertility center is free to make up its own policy. As Judith said, there's no law in place here, so some have them, some don't. And some centers say they're not going to do any type of postmortem sperm procurement, even if it's a spouse or a partner. So it's all over the place.
Okay.
32 years ago, I thought we should have some legislation. Kind of still waiting.
Yeah, and there's a void there. I did want to raise the cultural aspect of this, which would seem to me as a non-lawyer, a little dicey for the judge to consider, but I'm going to share what's part of the filing of the Northern California family and get our legal scholar Judith Darr to comment. In the filing, it says, our family comes from China, and an extremely important part of Chinese culture is the tradition of carrying on our family heritage. And explains that while Mr. Zhu has two brothers, both of them have one daughter, in part due to China's one-child policy. And the filing goes on to say, in Chinese culture, only a son carries on the family's name. Peter's the only male child in the Zhu family. Now, Judith Darr, is that something that the judge would likely consider here, that cultural issue?
Well, the judge is free to consider whatever he thought was relevant, but let me make 2 points about that. First of all, cultural issues have figured into these decisions, not necessarily in the U.S., but in other countries. These situations have unfolded in Israel, in which, in those cases, soldiers have been killed and the parents have retrieved sperm and actually have gone on to have children. Now, whether they're children of the parents themselves or grandchildren is another story altogether. And they do so under the guise of kind of a cultural pronatalist environment in that country. And so let me just come back to the other issue here, which is what would be the relationship between any child and the parents? For example, even if the parents are older, let's say the mom is postmenopausal, we have the technology today to allow her to be the gestational carrier. Doesn't matter that she wouldn't be and shouldn't be the egg provider. She could be technically made medically ready to carry the child. And if she gave birth, in some situations, she'd be considered the mother.
And if grandmother.
The child, yeah, and grandmother. So it creates this confusion. And in some cases, and we write about this in our ASRM opinion, it begins to simulate an incest union, which we really would want to discourage and stay away from. So I understand and honor the cultural sensitivities, but want to raise some of the complications that arise from considering those.
All right. Well, and back to the cultural issue that I was asking you about, then what would happen if the conception produces a female embryo? Then that wouldn't carry on the family name. That would not satisfy the particular issue that the Jews are trying to deal with.
Yeah, and that's a whole other area. I'd love to talk with you about that someday, the sex selection opportunity. And in most clinics, the parents would be able to select. And let's say, for example, that only female embryos were made, and then they decided not to proceed. I mean, that's a statement, cultural and otherwise, in and of itself, that I think is problematic.
Art Kaplan, I want to come back to you to hear your prescriptives. What do you think legally would be beneficial to enact by law, and what do we individually need to consider with this stuff?
Well, one thing we ought to do is consider modifying California law and the other states. The Uniform Anatomical Gift Act only really covers organs, but it could be extended to cover postmortem sperm desires about donating sperm and eggs, and by the way, uterus and testes and someday ovaries. These are being transplanted. They're reproductive too. So I think it's time to modify the law. Remember too, Larry, the only people who do this now are people who are somehow aware. Remember I mentioned hearing it on the radio years ago, but it's not routinely offered. The question is, should it be? When a young person dies and their spouse is interested, should they routinely have this offered to them? Another question, there are many, but the other one I'll mention is, should public money go for this? You know, we're using in vitro fertilization here. Judith mentioned testing embryos. That costs money. Is this something we feel people ought to have assistance with, or only the rich would be allowed to do it?
All right. So many different considerations and maybe a conversation with one's parents and spouse you never thought you'd have. So, Arthur Kaplan, bioethicist, professor of medical ethics, New York University School of Medicine. Art, thank you so much. And Judith Darr, dean-elect, Chase College of Law, Northern Kentucky University. And she chairs the Ethics Committee for the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. You can share your comments, pretty condemning right now, of the judge's decision in New York State. Air talk page, kpecc.org. Lot to talk about in hour two. I'll tell you about it momentarily.